Good morning. Just welcome you. Thank you for the honor of being able to present God's word to you this morning. Titled this message, Three Appearances and the Problem of Unbelief. And I don't know if you're like me, you kind of go through life and things come up, bumps in the road, and you stumble or whatever, and you struggle with just belief, believing God, believing that He is who He said He is, believing that you are who He says you are. And so this message actually is born out of a personal battle or struggle. But before I get into that, I want to go through the first couple of slides. I debated about even putting these up because it's not truly the point, I guess, of the message this morning, but I decided to go ahead and put them up because they're things that we can, I would assume, probably identify with. So you look around at the culture and over the last 50, 75 years, and we watch the culture kind of decline around us, and it's easy to be discouraged as God's people living in what is an increasingly godless society and godless world, which I suppose we shouldn't be surprised, right? Because Jesus said it's going to get worse and worse, right? Here are some of the things. Unbelief in America. These are some of the Supreme Court rulings over the last, I don't know, 50, 75 years. So prayer in schools becomes unconstitutional. Bible reading is too offensive. We can't be doing that anymore. Abortion legalized in 1973. Now, this was interesting. Until I actually started looking this up, I didn't realize Louisiana had a ban on it, teaching evolution in their public schools. That was reversed in 1987, which... oh, I was around back then. And then, you know, a lot of prayer graduations, 1992. And then in 2005, it was not constitutional to mandate or require the teaching of intelligent design. In 2011, Nancy Pelosi had her famous quote where she said that healthcare providers who refuse to perform abortions have this thing called conscience. To date, 5 states have legalized physician-assisted suicide: Oregon, California, Washington, Vermont, and Montana. From 2007 to 2014, the adults identifying as Christian in this nation dropped 7%. 7 percentage points in 7 years. And every year, 4,000 churches close their doors, while only 1,000 are planted, leaving a net loss of 3,000 churches, which seems like a lot of churches. That's the society that we live in. That's not my necessarily emphasis this morning, but I think if you're a member of God's family living in our society, there's a certain amount of identification that goes along with this, and it's sad. It bothers us. We see the culture decaying around us and just kind of falling into this godless abyss, right? And we wish there was something we could do, and it just seems like, you know, it just continues to decay. The real reason that I want to share this message with you this morning, though, comes from a very personal place. And Preston, as he mentioned, knew me, 18 years ago-ish, maybe 20, I don't know how long ago it was. It was a while. I grew up, In order for you to understand where I'm coming from, I want to share part of my story with you this morning. So I grew up very conservative Mennonite. And I want to say at the beginning that they are my people of origin. I love these people. So I get to poke fun at them, right? Because they're my people. So I get to make fun of them a little bit, okay? But I want to preface that by saying there's many, many great things about the culture in which I grew up, and I value many of those things very highly. I was taught all of the basic Christian beliefs, the belief in the Trinity, the omniscience and omnipresence of God, the divinity of Christ and the virgin birth, all those things that are main Christian beliefs. Those were things that I was taught. But then I was also taught some other things, right? Some things that were interesting. So for instance, when I was a little kid growing up, if I would have wanted to go to a church like this, I would have been a professing Christian. That's what we call them, professing Christians. It means, for those of you who aren't aware of the lingo, it means I profess the name of Christ, but maybe I don't really believe all the Bible says because, I mean, I have a wedding ring on. The Bible says don't wear jewelry, right? So, like, all these little nuances, right? So, people in a church like this might even have TV, might even go to the movies, right? I remember soon after my wife and I left the Mennonites, I had a friend from out of state who stopped in and visited, and he, like, looked over at my TV in the corner and was like, is that a TV? I'm like, no, it's my piano. Yeah, of course it's a TV. Come on, man. Yeah, so that's the kind of thing. So I had these, like, these presuppositions, and I don't share these things with you to put down anybody. I share them with you so that you understand where I came from. I also was a male in my family in a long line of Christian pastors and teachers. And the belief was that I would continue this tradition of being a pastor or a teacher of some kind. And so I thought, okay, that's a good idea. And I was getting to be a, you know, pretty good Christian by this point. So I figured, let's go to Bible college. And so I went to Bible college. And while I was in Bible college, I started to question some things about where I came from. And I started to wonder about, you know, some of these things that I've been, like, spoon-fed my whole life. And I remember very clearly coming to a point where I said, okay, I have these questions. And instead of being afraid of the answers, I'm going to seek the answers and see where it leads me, see where it takes me. I'm not going to be afraid of the destination. I'm going to pursue the journey. And so ultimately, I don't know, 12-ish years ago, my wife and I decided to leave the Conservative Mennonites. And it was one of the hardest things that I've ever done in my life. And because for the first time in my life, there was nobody there saying, here's what you need to believe. In fact, we have it all written down for you. Here it is in the Bible. And then here's some more things you get to believe. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, so that's gone. It's not there anymore. And I had to decide, okay, what do I really believe? And I went through a lot of difficult times because one of those beliefs that I had was that I should be a pastor, a teacher, right? And turns out I don't think I'd make a very good pastor. When you're a pastor, you're supposed to be patient with people, right? You're supposed to be kind and compassionate. And I'm not very patient. I'm just, you can ask my wife. Actually, probably not a good idea. Don't ask her. So what ended up being, for me, I embraced a lot of rejection and condemnation. And I felt like God had rejected me, even though in my head I could see, you know what, I wouldn't make a great pastor, I'd probably hurt a lot of people, and God pointed me in another direction. I felt a tremendous amount of rejection, a tremendous amount of condemnation, and a tremendous amount of pain. I looked at all my friends who were in Bible college, and I was like, they're pastoring, they're not perfect. You know, why me, God? Why did you take me a different direction? And so I owned that. I owned that unbelief. I owned that doubt of who God is and who I am. So over the next several years, there was a huge amount of reshaping and retooling as God was working in my life, but I struggled with this unbelief. I also decided to go into a career in the medical profession. And I met a lot of people of faith, but I also met a lot of cynicism and godlessness and unbelief. And I was around it all the time. And I don't know about you, but there's times in life where it just would be so much easier not to believe God. It would just be so much easier to say, you know what? It's just not worth it. There's so many reasons not to believe if that's what you're looking for. I mean, like, I was in a bad place. I couldn't even get to work sometimes without a fit of road rage, like knocking the wheels off my day, right? Like it was a rough time. And Fortunately, I had a great woman by my side who helped to stabilize me and keep me on my feet. But in these times when I felt like I was free falling, I doubted God's goodness. When all I could see was a hopeless mess, that's what I bought into. And yet, there was this little glimmer that I still wanted to believe. And I think that's what saved me. I've watched people struggle with unbelief and struggle with questions. And I'm here to tell you this morning, there is nothing wrong with questions. But when questions become the end instead of the journey, that's when the problem arises. I've watched people who get lost in the questions. They don't want answers. They love their questions. That's a problem. But there's nothing wrong with asking questions. Nothing wrong with seeking the truth and seeking where God's leading you. And so we come to the Gospel of Mark. G.K. Chesterton said, "When men stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything." A.W. Tozer said, "What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us." So Mark, I love this gospel. When I was a kid, I loved it because it was all stories, right? There wasn't a lot of like boring sermons, so it was all stories, and it was great to read as a kid. And as I got older and started studying a little bit more in depth in Bible college and wherever, seminary, and I realized, man, Mark is loaded. Mark is awesome. Mark is probably, I don't know, I like John too, but Mark is one of my favorite gospels. It's just loaded. And it was a gospel written by, it's thought to be written by John Mark, a close associate of Peter, and then the later companion of Paul and Barnabas on Paul's first missionary journey. It was a gospel written to a church in Rome, or at least, at the very least, to Gentile Christians, probably in the midst of persecution and trouble and difficulty, just intense difficulty. And so there's a strong belief in the book of Mark of belief versus unbelief. And sometime when you have like 45 minutes or an hour, just sit down and read the whole book at one time and look for this theme of belief. And it's all over. It's so cool. There's belief about people in general. There's belief, even it talks about Jesus being amazed at people's unbelief. Then there are like these little glimpses into people's lives, like the Syrophoenician woman or the centurion or Jairus, and gives a little picture into how these people believe. And then there's the disciples. And the disciples are the ones we're going to look at this morning. But they are just these bumbling group of people who can't quite get on their feet when it comes to belief. And they go through and they see all these miracles and they do all these miracles and still they're just like bumbling along and like they're like unbelief and they can't just figure it out, right? But Mark wants his readers to know right off the bat the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. There's no doubt anybody who picks up the book and starts to read it, there's no doubt. Mark says, "This is the Son of God." And at Jesus' baptism, there's the voice from heaven that says, "You are my son, the beloved. In you I am well pleased." There is no doubt. Mark sets it up right from the very beginning. Let's set this up. And let's know, I want my readers to know who we're dealing with, who this guy is. So we have the disciples. So just to kind of, I'm sorry, this is a long introduction, but bear with me. The introduction is probably as long as the actual sermon, so don't get too, I won't keep you long. I'm not usually very long-winded. But we have the disciples. And after calming the storm, so just a couple of instances I want to show you. After calming the storm, Jesus asks them, you know, they're riding in the boat, Jesus is sleeping, they freak out, and then Jesus gets up, he calms the storm, and he says, have you still no faith? After you've seen all this stuff, and, you know, I heal people and all this, have you still no faith? And they wonder, man, who is this? Even the wind and the sea obey him, right? Pretty incredible. Then after the feeding of the 5,000, the disciples see Jesus walking on the water. And again, you know, they're freaking out. It's a ghost, you know, whatever. And Jesus says, again, this is a direct translation. I think this is my opinion. I don't know. I haven't really read this. But Jesus said, I am. Do not be afraid. And I think this is a throwback to Moses in the burning bush, where God says to Moses, I am who I am. And Jesus is telling his disciples, I am. Don't be afraid. But they lack this understanding because the Bible says, Mark says, their hearts were hardened. They didn't understand the message of the feeding of the 5,000. Their hearts were hardened. They just, this whole belief thing, they're just not picking up on. And then finally, Jesus gets to the famous passage in Mark 8 where he says, who do people say that I am? Well, it really doesn't matter. Who do you say that I am? And Peter's like, Lord, you're the Messiah. And Jesus is like, yeah, you're right. And then he goes on, and Jesus begins from this point. This is kind of a turning point in the book of Mark. Jesus begins to tell them, this is what it looks like to be the Messiah. And there's like a whole bunch of talk about crucifixion and taking up your cross, and he's going to die. And the disciples, they just like, no, this isn't messianic talk. I don't know what you're talking about. So we're going to take a time out. And we're going to talk about which one of us is going to be the greatest, because we like that conversation better than Jesus dying on the cross. Messiahs don't die on crosses, by the way. Not in Jewish history, not in Jewish expectation. Messiahs don't die on crosses. And then we have this one more instance here that I want to point out to you in Mark chapter 9, where the disciples are... Jesus is away, the disciples are there, and this man brings his son, who is possessed, Bible says, by a demon, and the disciples can't cast him out. They've cast out other demons. This one they're not able to. And Jesus comes, and he says, O faithless generation, how much longer will I be with you? And I got to assume he's talking to the disciples, right? Because they're the ones who couldn't cast it out. So faithless generation, referring to the disciples. And the father, this son, is just beside himself. He's like, Jesus, if you can do anything, have pity on us and help us. And Jesus is like, if you are able, all things can be done for the one who believes. And I love this. The father of the child cries out, I believe. Help my unbelief. Get me over the edge. Take me where I need to be. And Jesus heals his son. But the disciples just don't get it. They don't understand. Now, finally, we get to today's text. Mark 16. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome brought spices so they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, who will roll the stone away from the entrance to the tomb? And when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, don't be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. But go and tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you. So they went out, and they fled from the tomb in terror and amazement. And they said nothing to anyone, because they were afraid. So, just as a backdrop to this, the Jewish people this time didn't believe in embalming. So this is just an act of devotion. These women are coming to care for the body of their master, their Lord, that they loved. This wasn't, we're going to embalm him. No, this was an act of devotion. And I would just, as I read this, I'm just thinking, where are the dudes? Like, where are they? The women are already worried about who's going to roll the stone away. But, you know, Peter, no, Peter's not interested. John, you want to come along? And no, not. Well, no, Thomas isn't, because he's just a perpetual doubter. So they're all by themselves, and I don't know what they're thinking, but they're going. And when they get there, the stone's already rolled away, and they're terrified. Matthew identifies the young man as an angel. In Matthew's account, there's two of them, two angels announcing that Jesus has been raised from the dead. And so the angel says, go, tell his disciples, let them know. And they're scared. They're like freaked out. And I can't blame them. I mean, like, if I go to, I don't like, you know, walking in graveyards is bad enough, but you actually like go to a tomb and walk in there, that's a little creepy. I probably wouldn't have been there either. But these women, I think this demonstrates how much they truly loved and were devoted to Jesus. And there they are. But they were afraid. And Mark says they didn't say anything to anyone because they were afraid. So here's the first appearance. Now, after he rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast seven demons. She went out and told those who had been with him while they were mourning and weeping. But when they heard he was alive and had been seen by her, they would not believe it. Now, we don't know a lot about Mary Magdalene. And it's so interesting because multiple times we're told that she has had seven demons cast out of her. But we never actually get the narrative. There's never a story where one of the gospel writers says, okay, Jesus is walking along and here's a woman, she has seven demons and it's Mary Magdalene. No, we don't hear the actual account. We just hear what happened to her. Some writers have suggested that maybe she was a prostitute in her former life. There's no evidence. It's just conjecture. We really don't know anything about this woman. All we know is that she was extremely troubled before she met Jesus. And once she met Jesus and was healed, her life changed. And she's listed in Luke 8 as being one of the ones who provided for Jesus during his ministry. She used her own resources to minister to Jesus along with some other women. And so she is like her, while the disciples, you look at the contrast, while the disciples are busy arguing about who's going to be the greatest, these women are devoting themselves to serving their master. And so I think maybe that's a key into looking at why were the women the ones who went to the tomb? Why were they the ones who even pursued this? The disciples, they were holed up. So Mary sees Jesus, and I don't know if you can imagine. Here is a woman who is heartbroken, who's going to anoint the body of her beloved master, and suddenly she realizes he's not dead. He's alive. And she races back to tell the disciples who were mourning and weeping. And they refuse to believe. I have the answer to your grief. But they refuse to believe. So what does this say about Mary? You're a liar. You're delusional. We're not going to believe you. We saw him die. It's over. Logic. Come on, he's done. And Mary comes with this great news. And they ignored her credibility. This was not in keeping. The assumption, let's say, I don't know what they thought. Mary's delusional, she's seen it, I don't know. But this assumption isn't in keeping with the Mary that they watched during the years of Jesus' ministry. This assumption flies in the face of the Mary who is devoted to Jesus. But this is what they chose. So here we go. Unbelief. Unbelief perpetuates cycles of grief and wounding. So I'm just going to ask you for just a second, consider your own life. I'm going to assume that you probably have areas of grief and wounding and pain because you're a person and you're more than a day old. So you've had trouble. You've had difficulty in your life. And I want you to think just for a second. I want you to think about the beliefs that you have that are associated with those woundings and those hurts and that pain. Maybe it's, I'm not good enough. Maybe it's, God doesn't care about that part of my life. Maybe it's, I'll never be anything. I'm worthless. I don't know what it is. But I just want you to think about that. Unbelief perpetuates cycles of grief and wounding. Unbelief also destroys the credibility of yourself and others. First of all, if you're a Christian and you struggle with unbelief, there's not a lot of chance that anybody else is going to believe in you, right? Because you struggle with unbelief. Second of all, imagine Mary. She's been delivered. She has this great news, and she goes to the disciples, and they don't believe her. How do you think Mary felt at this point? Does she begin to even question, well, maybe I didn't really see him. Like, I don't know. Maybe the demons are back. Maybe I'm delusional. Maybe with the death of Christ, maybe I'm back at square one. Unbelief destroys credibility. Then we come to the second appearance. After this, Jesus appeared in another form to two of them as they were walking into the country, and they went back and told the rest, but they didn't believe them. So Luke has an extended account of this. Luke chapter 24, it's very interesting, you should read it sometime, identifies the disciple as one of them as Cleopas. So we kind of know that at least one of these isn't one of the 11, right? Probably neither one of them. But at least one of them isn't one of the 11 disciples. They're walking along the road to Emmaus. Jesus appears as they're walking along, and he's like, hey, you know, what are you guys talking about? And they said, are you a stranger? Do you not know? I mean, like we heard last Sunday. I mean, when Jesus came into Jerusalem riding on a donkey, there were hundreds of thousands of people in Jerusalem. This wasn't something that happened obscurely. This wasn't something that nobody knew about. This was front page news. And Jesus asked them, hey, what are you guys talking about? They're like, what? Where are you from? And so they told him. And then Jesus begins to explain all these events in the light of the prophetic voice of the Old Testament. And it's getting late. They're getting close to Emmaus. And they say, hey, look, just stay with us. Come on in. Stay with us. Have some food. And just like, okay, I'll come in. And then as they begin to eat, the disciples recognize it's Jesus. And he's gone. He's gone. And they're so excited. And they race back to Jerusalem 7 miles in the evening. I don't know about you, but in the evening, I don't want to walk 7 miles. I don't want to go anywhere fast. I want to sit on the couch and, sit in front of my awful TV and watch a little TV. So they race back to Jerusalem. They're excited. They have this news. And they didn't believe him. Well, we came all this way and you're just going to like laugh in our face? Now imagine that you're in this room and there's the disciples and there's Mary Magdalene and there's these two that come in. They're like, we saw Jesus. And no, you didn't. And so the two disciples and Mary, they start sharing their accounts, and they compare accounts, and they say, yeah, he said this, and he looked like this, and oh, we just knew it was him. And the 11 like, nah. Here's the deal. Unbelief divides the people of God. Imagine the tension. Imagine what's going on in this room, and these people, they're people of God, right? Unbelief divides us. Unbelief separates us into categories and groups. Then we have the third appearance. Later, Jesus appeared to the 11 themselves as they were sitting at the table, and he upbraided them for their lack of faith and stubbornness because they had not believed those who saw him after he had risen. And he said to them, go into all the world and proclaim the good news to the whole creation. The one who believes and is baptized will be saved, but the one who does not believe will be condemned. Again, let's go over to Luke. Luke says they were terrified. They thought it was a ghost. Of course they thought it was a ghost. They didn't believe anybody. This was not possible. They think it's a ghost. And Jesus says, don't be afraid. It's really me. And here's the kicker. The root of unbelief. If you notice, Jesus didn't rebuke them because their society was in a mess. He didn't rebuke them because Peter denied him or because they ran away when he was being crucified. He didn't rebuke them for any of those reasons. He rebuked them because of stubbornness and lack of belief. Other translations say unbelief and hardness of heart. See, the root of unbelief isn't what's happening around us. It's what's happening within us. That's the root of unbelief. And that's what Jesus was calling them out on. My own choices, my own thought patterns create unbelief. It's not the eroding culture around me. It's not the godless people I work with. It's not the driver that cuts me off. It's not any of that stuff. It's my own thought patterns. It's the lies that I buy into, that I take, and that I own. And so the healing of our unbelief doesn't come in improved legislation. It doesn't come in electing a president who shares our values. It doesn't come with a return to old-fashioned morals. It comes with an encounter with the resurrected Christ. That's what heals our unbelief. It doesn't come from finding the right church or the right career or the right income or going on vacation or having a retirement account. If we, like Peter, when he tried to walk on the waves, only see the waves, if we only see the checkbook in the red, if we only see the illnesses, if we only see the sickness and the bills and the car repairs, if we only see the broken relationships and the hurt and the pain that we're dealing with, if we only see those things, we'll never find healing. We'll never come to a point where we can release that and let it go. Unbelief will never become belief until we come into the presence of the resurrected Messiah. The disciples, from this time on, never questioned. They never questioned Christ again. They went out and proclaimed the message at the expense of their own lives. You see, here's the thing. When the disciples were crushed and broken, sitting in that upper room, everything they believed in and worked toward for the last 3 years just lay in rubble at their feet, because dead messiahs aren't messiahs at all. They're frauds. They're not messiahs. So the moment Jesus breathed his last and said, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit," it was over in their mind. It was done. Dead messiahs aren't really messiahs. So the resurrection changed everything. It showed the disciples that the kingdom of God has come in a brand new way, one that we didn't recognize and we didn't anticipate and we never saw coming. The resurrected Messiah changes everything. The past, the present, and the future are all rewritten when we come into the presence of the resurrected Messiah, and we feel his embrace. You see, you can argue with theory, you can argue with facts, you can argue with arguments. You'll never convince somebody to believe anything that they don't want to believe in. But it's really hard to argue with an embrace of love. When you come into the presence of a resurrected Christ, you can't argue with that. It changes you forever. So the result of this healing is that the disciples are finally able to fulfill God's good purposes for their lives. Look at what it says at the end of Mark. The disciples went out and proclaimed the good news everywhere. They never looked back. They took it with them. And I'm not here to say, like, I don't know that this is a conversion. I think this is an account that directly speaks to unbelief. And so sometimes, I don't know if you're like me, I need this encounter again and again. And I go through my life and I go through bumps in the road, or there's stuff that comes up and I struggle with unbelief. We need to experience again the resurrected Messiah. I don't know what it's like for you. For me, I like to experience Christ in nature and in music. Sometimes it comes through reading the Bible, but more often it comes through quietness in nature, listening to music. That's when God speaks to me. I don't know what it is for you. I don't know where you find the Messiah. I don't know where he speaks to you, but I want to tell you this morning, if you are going through life and you're experiencing unbelief, it's probably not your circumstances. It's probably because you just need to sit down with Jesus for a little while. Just listen to him. Hear what he has to say. Instead of a closing prayer, I'm going to have you listen to a song, and then we'll be dismissed.